Welcome, troopers, to episode 106 of the Nerdstravaganza podcast. An episode that would have worked slightly better were at episode 105. I'm Tom.
I'm Eric.
I'm Brian.
And I say it would have worked better as episode 105 because today we are welcoming special guest Anthony from the 501st Legion Star Wars costuming group. And so 105 would have worked better for fairly obvious reasons. That opportunity being lost to us notwithstanding, however, let us kick things off in true Imperial style with our weekly geekly dark-sided roundup. Brian, what have you done in the service of the Emperor this week?
I picked up the both of the huge ships for X-Wing minis, so it's not so mini anymore. But I have just been reading the scenarios and admiring the amazing models and getting ready for this week's fun, exciting, like 900 point gaming session. Should be a lot of fun. That Tantive IV is very impressive in my opinion.
You're, of course, referring to the massive additions to the X-Wing miniatures game that we are going to be playing this Thursday. This is our X-Wing night coming up, right?
Yeah, I'm seriously stoked. I think it's going to be a cool, cool scenario.
I'm looking forward to it.
And the other thing I did, and you know, I kind of joke about everybody hating Will Wheaton, so I almost hate to pick on him, but did anyone else see the Will Wheaton project?
No.
No, I haven't.
So its big release was last week, and I was kind of excited for it because I really liked Tabletop, and I really thought it would be this cool thing. It's Tosh 3.0.
Oh, really?
It's really bad. It's really bad.
Is so he making fun of the same kind of stuff like Daniel Tosh is making fun of, or is it just like...
It's all like clips of news off the internet. And he's doing, like, cheesy one-liners. And at one point, like, he actually, like, kind of rolled his eyes, like, to the camera in this, like, guys, they're making me do it, like, gesture. And I was just like, wow. You guys, seriously, I think it's on tonight. So check for reruns or DVR or something like that. I really want your opinions.
So it is just him curating web content.
Yes.
Not excited. I will have to check that out. Anyway, a low point of the week. Anything else?
That's it for me.
That may be it for me, too. This may be the end of television for me. Eric, over to you.
Let's see. This is actually a two-week span. I'm sure we're going to get into Star Wars Weekends quite a bit in the episode, but it was a lot of fun. Not only did we do the Star Wars Weekends aspect, prior to that, on Friday, we did the overnight at the Magic Kingdom here in Orlando, and that was a lot of fun. I admit, I thought I was going to hit the wall around 11, and I did. 5-hour energy kind of lives up to its name. It pretty much pushed me through the whole night and had a blast, had a lot of fun. The other thing I want to talk about was this past weekend was WWDC, Apple's big developers conference, and while I'm happy with most of what they had to offer, and I actually don't have any complaints about anything they presented from the new OSs, most of it is kind of awesome stuff, they got one-upped and no one noticed. Microsoft participated in a new convention called CodeCon, where they showed off something, and this is something that I get all excited about. Every once in a while, we get a new piece of technology, and that technology is what I like to refer to as, and most people refer to as, Star Trek technology, where you're like, that's Star Trek technology. Like, the first time I saw an iPad, I was like, that's Star Trek technology. Or when I saw 3D printing of food, I was like, Star Trek technology. And I want to point out, we're using Skype to do this podcast. So we like Skype. They showed off something called Skype Translate, which I recommend everyone look it up. We'll post a link. Basically, on the fly, it is translating languages via Skype. So you're doing a video conference. You're talking to each other in two different languages. It's listening to you. And then immediately following your talking, translating it in text speech to speech, I guess, in this case.
That is pretty Star Trek, yes.
Yeah, it was amazing. And they did a demo where one person was speaking English with an Indian accent, and it recognized them perfectly, I might add. And the other person on the other end is speaking German, and I speak a little bit of German, and it did a pretty damn good job. Like, I was impressed. It wasn't perfect.
I'm impressed, too, just hearing about it. Sorry, go ahead.
It wasn't perfect, nor would I ever expect something like this to be perfect while it's, like, in alpha or beta or whatever it is, or even a first launch I wouldn't expect to be perfect. But it was damn impressive.
The future is here. Thank you, Microsoft. Pretty cool week for you. Anything else, or does that wrap it up?
That pretty much wraps it up. I do want to add one other thing, and this is kind of just a news thing that I read. Because the other things, like, you know, I actually actively watched those conventions or watched the presentations. But I did catch a little piece of news that I just thought was funny, which was Brazil is hosting the World Cup, so obviously they're upping their police force. Now, I could care less about soccer. I don't care about the World Cup. I'm sure I have just offended. I mean, if our fan base is anything like the world populace, we're going to lose 95% of our fans because I don't like soccer. However, oh, I will point out I don't like soccer because it's not hockey. However, they've showed off this week their uniforms for, like, basically their version of the riot police. And their words, not the newspaper's words, not some geek website's words, their words were the inspiration for the uniforms, and you have to check these out, are a combination of RoboCop and Darth Vader.
Wow. Are you kidding me?
And they look exactly like a copy of RoboCop and Darth Vader.
That's pretty cool. So they're trying to get this intimidating look for their uniforms.
Yeah, that's exactly what they said, that they wanted. They felt those characters were intimidating, especially for a police force, and hopefully by being intimidating, they can be preventative, like be proactive in stopping things.
Wow, that's disturbingly geeky and in a strange way, cool. I don't want to admit it's cool, but it kind of is.
It's cool in a mildly dystopian way.
There you go. It's cool in a, like, it'd be cool to fight against these guys in my mech way.
Right.
Wow. Okay, now does that conclude your update?
That does. That's the end of it there.
Okay, we had kind of a bye week this week. There was Brian's birthday, which was a big event, and I was going out of town to a graduation party for some family. And so I did a lot of watching of the Clone Wars show, which I have been doing more of at the urging of a friend who convinced me with this article that basically implied that it's kind of essential to watch Clone Wars in order for the episode 2 to 3 transition to make any sense. I'm still not sure to what degree Ahsoka Tano, whatever her name is, leading a bunch of Mandalorian Academy youth in a revolution against the corrupt Mandalorian government has to do with bridging that gap, but I'm sure it has something to do with it.
The Mandalorian youth, is that like their own Hitler youth?
Shockingly, it's very similar. The Mandalorians are like Aryans. I don't know if you've watched this show, but they are like seriously all like blonde-haired, blue-eyed, like Nordic, like warrior people.
I have not watched a lot of Clone Wars. I've like been like one of those weird people who's just like, oh, here's an episode that happens to be on right now. I'll leave that on in the background. And I've seen some things that I thought were cool and some things that weren't. But I haven't like been like, okay, I'm going to watch this episode to episode. But maybe I should.
It gets better. I'm in season 3. And I will say that what most people say is it gets better as you go. And so far it has. Except for certain pauses in the action to go on some kind of silly side quests. But I'm starting to actually enjoy it, so I do recommend that. And so that's been occupying a lot of my time. And in addition, never want to pass up a trip to like a cool, fantastic Wonderland. Well, you know, as you know, the week before last, we did go to the Disney 24 Hours event and did attend Star Wars Weekend, which is where we got to see tonight's guest marching in costume. We did that, and then this week, while I was up visiting family in Northern Kentucky for this special event, I wanted to keep up the, what's the word I'm looking for, fantasy, fiction, etc. So I fulfilled a lifelong dream and went to the coolest amusement park in Northern Kentucky. That, of course, being the Creation Museum.
No.
Oh, yes. Oh, yes.
Yeah, you know what? I'm not even going to get into it because this is a whole episode. It's a whole episode. We can't. No.
Okay, and just like that, we have an offensive, divisive next episode. Tom goes to the Creation Museum. Brian, are you with that?
How is that geeky?
Well, it's nerd extravaganza. We can argue that nerd is science related in a lot of ways.
Yeah, let me give you a brief sales pitch live during the episode, and if you don't like it, we can just move on to something else next week. But basically, the implication there is that, you know, the world is very young and was created according to this account. And then if you don't believe that, because people don't believe in that account of how the world was created, we have like nuclear bombs and wolves and like all this like terrible stuff. So there's a science angle. There's kind of a pretty fantastic fantasy angle. I don't know. You're not feeling it still?
I'm dying. Like, I want to ask questions. Like, I'm like, wait, they grouped wolves and atomic bombs together, but I can't ask questions right now. I have to stop. I'm just going to go breathe over there somewhere and then I'll be back.
I don't see how it'd be anything but a piss fest, but,
Oh, Brian's not feeling it, Eric. I think we may not be able to do it next week. Oh, well, possible future topic. I went to the Creation Museum and, saw an interesting take on the origins of the Earth and where believing in alternative theories for the evolution of life on Earth can lead mankind.
Yeah, so join Tom and I in our spinoff podcast, Evolution Ganza. Yeah.
Origins Ganza, the origin of life. Anyway, that's pretty much it. Went to a few fantasy parks, watched some Clone Wars, and that's more or less it. Okay, so I guess with our updates out of the way, we can now move on to the main topic, which is a discussion with tonight's guest, Anthony, of the 501st Legion. Let's kick this sucker off. Okay, we are now happy to welcome our special guest and Star Wars expert, Anthony, of the 501st Legion. Should I call it 501st or 501st? What's it called colloquially?
It usually goes by the 501st.
Boom, I knew I had it. Your Legion designation, I believe, is TIE 28803. Is that correct?
That is correct.
Excellent. Now, what does TIE signify something that I'm not a big enough Star Wars geek to recognize besides TIE fighter?
Well, that's exactly it. TIE means that one of my costumes is a TIE pilot. That's one of several costumes that I have.
Oh, so you have to have a serviceable TIE costume in order to gain that designation?
That is correct. You have to have a approved 100% screen accurate costume.
Awesome. I am impressed that you were able to get together what I'm sure is a collection of costumes, but a TIE costume in particular. So am I picturing like the guys that Vader tells to come with him, basically?
Yep, the guys in black that you see piloting the TIE fighters.
That is pretty badass.
Yeah, they're pretty awesome. They're a pretty small part of the movie. They only have a couple seconds of screen presence, but they're still pretty badass.
I think we can infer that they are the ones flying all those swarms of TIE fighters there, right?
Oh, yes, indeed.
Cool. Well, I think before we beat you up with a million questions about your particular costumes, maybe we could get a little background from you on the 501st for those who don't know in our audience.
Sure. The 501st Legion started in 1997 by a couple people actually not too far from where I live now in South Carolina, and it has since grown. I believe it's currently has over 6,000 members in over 50 countries around the globe, so it's grown quite a bit. Out of those 6,000 members, I think there's over 11,000 approved costumes. So it's the largest Star Wars costuming group in the world, and it's also the Lucas preferred costume group.
Yeah, when you say Lucas preferred, if I'm not mistaken, has not the 501st been featured in at least one Star Wars game? I'm thinking a Battlefront game.
That is correct. It has been featured. The 501st isn't a part of Lucasfilm, but I say Lucas preferred because George Lucas has shown his support and named the 501st as his preferred costuming organization. Definitely the go-to organization for different events that they have all over the world.
Okay, awesome. I am impressed and impressed that you belong to such a high-profile group, I guess I could say.
It's definitely a good time. There's a lot of pretty dedicated people, part of this organization, and it does a lot of good. It's, you know, a lot of the events are just fun type cons and things like that, but the Legion also does a lot of charity work and raises a lot of money for a lot of different organizations.
Awesome, man. Always good to do good while having fun.
Indeed, and that's one of the main reasons that the Legion even exists. It started as a charity organization and does a lot of good for a lot of different children's organizations, and that's definitely a key part of it.
That's cool. We tried to get a children's charity together here. We were showing up at parties and offering to make balloon animals, but most of the parents just asked us to leave, which is a little disheartening.
Balloon animals are so fun.
Yeah, you're supposed to blow them up with your mouth, Tom.
I'm not sure what you're implying, Eric, but I'm going to move on. I think you had some kind of question to ask.
Yeah, my question was this. I mean, I know it started in South Carolina and it has since spread. When I hear the number 6,000, and I'm going to be honest, to me that's a small number. And I know that part of the reason why is that the uniforms have to be insanely screen specific. So, for example, doing a TIE fighter outfit or costume, like, what details do you need to be aware of? Like, how specific are the specifics?
It's insanely specific. And 6,000, when I look at it, knowing how specific it is, 6,000 actually impresses me, because it takes so much work and so much effort to get a provable costume. The attention to detail is from head to foot, every little detail. Most of it is things that you would never even think of. There's details on my suit that I never even knew existed, things that you can't even see in the movies sometimes. But it's really, really kind of painstaking at times. We have something called a costume reference library, which goes into detail of every single part, every single, garment, every single piece of armor, every electronic feature. There's fine details that have to be 100% accurate.
So this is not something you would just be like, oh, this sounds like fun, it's Star Wars, I'm going to do that. You have to be pretty dedicated, I would imagine.
Definitely. And it makes it that much harder when you factor in, you can't just go out and buy a suit. You have to piece it together. You have to fabricate a lot of it yourself. You have to source out certain parts, and you have to size it to you. And that all takes a lot of time, work, and energy, not to mention money.
That was my next question, which is, how much do you think you've invested in, let's say, just one costume, so the TIE fighter costume, for example?
Well, my TIE pilot, I would say I have probably around $1,500 invested in it. And compared to a lot of costumes, that's definitely on the cheap side.
What are some of the expensive ones?
Some of the people that are putting together some of the bounty hunters or a Vader, those can get pretty pricey. I've heard of some people putting in $7,000-$8,000 into them.
What do you think it would cost me to put together a sexy Twi'lek slave girl turned assassin costume?
I don't know if I could really put a price tag on something like that.
That's what I wanted to hear. It sounds pretty priceless to me, and I don't know why I asked about that. I have no intention of wearing any such thing ever.
That's disappointing.
to many. Most of all to Brian, I suspect. Brian, you've been awfully quiet. You must have questions.
I'm actually I don't know if I'm the only one that doesn't know this, so I was kind of being quiet about it, but when you say the 501st was included in games, is that because of you guys, or are you guys because of that?
Well, a little bit of both. There's definitely been some bones thrown to the 501st from Lucasfilm and other, like some of the authors who have written some of the expanded universe books. Since the 501st has become active and has become as large as it has, it's definitely been included in a lot more side stories since its creation.
But it was a canon designation before you guys?
I'd have to double check my history on the Legion, but I believe that the 501st was initially written as a legion of stormtroopers that were personally assigned to Darth Vader.
All right, so now that we have kind of a broad idea of what the 501st is, how exactly did you get involved?
Well, I've always seen members of the 501st out and about at different conventions, you know, Star Wars Celebration, different events here and there. And it's kind of always piqued my curiosity. And what really inspired me was after going to Celebration 6 in Orlando, that's what really kind of pushed me over the edge, saying I wanted to build something and get involved, because it just looked like it was a really good time. So that Celebration 6 was the summer of 2012, and as soon as I got home from that, it's when I started doing some research on what kind of costume I could put together and what I had to do to get involved.
What kind of like charities, you said, like it's beneficial? What have you been involved in?
Since I have become involved with the Legion, I've done several charities. A lot of them have been for Make-A-Wish Foundation. I'd say that's probably one of the top charities that the 501st supports. A lot of events to, you know, raise money for that. We also do a lot of charity events with children's hospitals. Here in North Carolina, there's a couple hospitals that we'll do annual visits to, where we'll go dressed as, you know, a variety of characters and go and visit the kids and spend some time with them. That's always a kind of a tough one to do. But we'll go into some of the wards where, you know, some of the kids are terminally ill, and you know, it's pretty cool to see their expressions and see how excited they get to see us coming in. And that's definitely a pretty rewarding experience. Another big one that we do around the holidays is we do a lot of work with Toys for Tots, where we'll do a lot of toy drives and try to bring in a lot of donations for families in need.
And does the 501st have like a branch devoted to searching that stuff out, or does it just, you know, does someone come up with the idea, or how did you guys get involved?
Well, the 501st is geographically set up with what they have, they call them garrisons. So I'm part of the Carolina Garrison, which is made up of North Carolina and South Carolina. And each garrison has a command staff in place, and all of the different positions in that command staff have different responsibilities. One of those positions is an event coordinator, garrison event coordinator, and they are the point of contact for different charities for organizing different events. Myself, I'm what they call a regional representative. So I'm the 501st representative for the part of North Carolina that I live in. And I'm the point of contact for the Asheville area or the Western North Carolina area. And I organize a lot of those events and work with a lot of those groups to set things up.
That's pretty awesome, man. I know Brian is, we're all obviously very civic minded, I think, and interested in, what would you call it, Brian, charitable involvement or civic involvement, I guess.
Yeah, civic mindedness.
I think the word we used on our 101 episode was community.
Yeah, and it's pretty encouraging to hear that such a large and influential group as yours is so actively involved in actually doing good for others. That's great.
Yeah, and they really do a lot worldwide. It's amazing how much the Legion accomplishes. You know, every year they do an end of the year report that kind of summarizes how many events, how many charities that we worked with, and of course how much of an impact we had. And every year the monetary amount that's raised is just mind blowing.
Let me ask you this: you said you have like a command staff, and I'm sure you were speaking metaphorically, but is this a full time job for anybody?
It's not a full-time job. I mean, the work that's done can definitely be full-time, but it's all volunteer-based. It's all done in people's spare time. Everybody that's involved with the 501st, you know, everybody is obviously has other commitments, families, careers, everything that anybody else is going to be dealing with. But everybody just finds time to be a part of this because it's something that everybody's pretty passionate about and feels strongly about and has a lot of fun doing. So we find time to make it happen.
Very cool. Very cool. As someone who volunteers on a tiny basis and then gets caught up like reading the latest novel or whatever and thinking that I could do more. I congratulate you guys.
Thank you. It's definitely, you know, that's appreciated. And it, like I said, it's a lot of fun. It's really cool to be able to go out and do something that's that fun. I mean, I get to dress up as Star Wars characters and go out and see kids and parents flip out when they see stormtroopers and Darth Vader coming. And that's a pretty awesome experience to be able to see that kind of reaction.
Yeah, I'll bet, man. That sounds pretty cool. And it sounds like you guys have been able to kind of square the circle that we're always kind of wrestling with, both on the show and in our private discussions for, you know, we've got regarding how to harness all of this like nerdy energy for good. You know, people devote so much time to their hobbies and interests. And if you can capture even a portion of that and direct it towards doing good for others, I think you've accomplished something pretty great. So I think you and your organization are to be commended.
Thanks. That's definitely appreciated.
Speaking of Vader, is that like a seniority thing? Does like only one person get to be Vader after 5 years, or?
Anybody can build any costume they want, but we do try to coordinate. So if we have an event, we'll coordinate on our forums that only the 501st members can see. So we'll know what characters are coming. So that way we don't have two Vaders that show up at a location, because that would just probably confuse people and make someone's head explode.
Speaking of exploding, and I guess that brings to mind the Death Star being blown up in what can only be described as an awful terrorist attack on the part of the Rebellion. I learned during the Star Wars Weekends Parade, which I should mention, we did see you march in.
I was there.
And we will get back to that in a moment. But I noticed it was announced that there were rebel counterparts to the 501st. Is that true?
That is true. Our sister organization is the Rebel Legion. The Rebel Legion is all the good guys. The 501st is strictly the bad guys. So if you want to be a bad guy, you join the 501st. If you want to be a good guy or a Jedi, you join the Rebel Legion.
As a percentage, not that you know the specifics, but as a percentage of the Rebel Legion, how many do you think are Jedi? I'm guessing they're overrepresented.
There's definitely a lot of Jedis, but there's a lot of other really cool costumes too. There's a lot of X-wing pilots, you name it. Any good character you've seen in the movies, I'm willing to bet somebody has created a costume for that.
Does that include Ewoks?
It does. There are Ewoks.
A lot of Gungans in attendance.
Well, I have heard rumors about there being a few. I can't confirm that, though. I haven't seen them in person.
Shockingly, the Gungans are not invited to many events.
I hear they're out there somewhere, though.
Yeah, we actually saw some 501st members on a Star Wars day for a minor league baseball team in Jupiter, Florida. And now all I can get in my head is if someone showed up as a Gungan on like Free Bat Day, how well that would play out.
Yeah, you could probably drum up a lot of attention with that one. The sporting events are always a good time. I did a baseball game last year. It was a lot of fun. Actually, they asked me if I wanted to go out and throw the first pitch in costume. But I was dressed as an Imperial gunner at the time, and my vision is incredibly limited. So I decided not to make a fool of myself, and I passed on that opportunity.
Yeah, I can't even imagine how you'd whip your arm around with the back of that helmet. So
I'd probably end up knocking the helmet off my head and being laughed at.
That actually brings me to the next question. How many costumes do you have?
I have 3 approved costumes right now, and I'm working on a fourth. I have approved right now. I have my TIE pilot. I also have what they call a reserve pilot, which is basically a TIE pilot minus the armor and wearing the Imperial cap, which is actually a character that you can see briefly in the movies. And then my third approved costume is the Imperial gunner, also known as the guys that, you know, fired that giant laser off of the Death Star and blew up Alderaan.
Are we talking about the guys with the funky helmets?
That's the ones with the big oblong-shaped helmets.
Yeah, those are cool. That way they can see better when they're looking down the barrel of that gigantic planet-killing gun. They get a better eye for what they're targeting, right?
It must, because straight forward is the only direction you can see. You have absolutely no vision in any other direction.
Now the pitch thing is really sounding complicated.
Yeah, I didn't see that going over very well, so I think I chose wisely by passing.
Yeah, I would say so. Would you say that there are favorite characters? I mean, I think it seems to me that the Imperial side gives you a lot more freedom to be like a stormtrooper, because there's just so many stormtroopers, and by virtue of the fact that they wear armor and masks, you know, they are, I don't want to say anonymous, but they are, it allows for a lot of people to play an integral part, right? Because there were just so many freaking stormtroopers. But with the Rebels, it seems like they focused a lot more in on specific characters in the movies. And I guess that's not for no reason. They're the good guys. You know what I mean? And chime in here, guys, if you think I'm off in the weeds. But, you know, I picture like a lot of Porkins running around, a lot of people who want to play Wedge, even though we know that in the Rebel Alliance, there must have been thousands of pilots and troopers and every other kind of military role, I guess. Are people content to be like, you know, hey, I'm Endor Soldier 772?
Yeah, it's amazing how many obscure characters there are. And, you know, people that, you know, I don't look at the Death Star gunner, the Imperial gunner, as being that obscure. But I guess unless you're a diehard Star Wars fan, you're really not going to notice who that is. I did one event last year where for the first 2 hours, I was the only trooper there, and I was trooping as the Imperial gunner. And it was amazing how many people just had no idea who I was. I had one person come up and call me RoboCop. So, you know, so, but a lot of people do enjoy dressing up as some of those obscure characters on both the Rebel side and on the 501st side. But yeah, without a doubt, you know, with the 501st, there's a ton of stormtroopers. There's definitely more stormtroopers in the Legion than any other character. But that's pretty awesome, because I think it's pretty awesome when you go to an event and there's, you know, 20, 30 stormtroopers all dressed up and all in line. It looks badass.
I got to ask this question. When choosing the costume you're going to build or choosing the costume you want to design, I'm sure 90% of it is like, I love the look of that character. I want to be that character. But I got to assume the other 10% is like, what physical attributes that do I already have that might lend well to a good character? Like, for example, like, I'm fairly average in height and probably fairly average in weight. But the one thing I think I have that might be a problem when designing something is the fact that I wear glasses. Like, I can't be the only, like, you know, rebel trooper. I can't be the only X-Wing fighter with glasses on, since that wasn't in a movie. So how much do you think people take into account, like, their physical attributes before they build something?
Yeah, I'm sure it probably crosses people's minds, but, you know, that's not a deal breaker for building a costume. Obviously, you know, the 501st and the Rebel Legion are open to all shapes and sizes. You know, some costumes might be more limiting than others, depending on your size. You know, some might be tougher to get into if you're a certain height or if you're, you know, shorter than others. But by all means, if you can pull it off, then go for it.
See, now I'm just picturing like a 4 foot tall Vader.
Well, you know, there are some people that dress as Vader that are surprisingly short, and it surprises me. But there's one guy I know who does a Vader, and he has lifts in his shoes that bring him up to a pretty impressive height. You would never know it when you see him in his suit, but when you come afterwards, when he's out of it, you're like, wow, how are you Vader? It's the same thing with the Wookiees. When you see the Wookiees, you know, they're 7 foot plus, but they're all on, you know, they've got stilts built into their costumes and find ways to make it work.
I was going to mention that, actually, and this brings me back to the Star Wars Weekend Parade we saw you in at Disney's Hollywood Studios, to give it the current politically correct name, always known to us as MGM.
Always.
Thank you. I saw a Wookiee walk by, and I'm like, man, that is a tall dude. And then only when I looked closely, because the person was doing such a great job walking, only after like scrutinizing fairly closely could I tell that it looked like they were walking on, what are they, like leg extensions or stilts or something?
Yeah, it's kind of like, I believe they use kind of like a painter's stilt, kind of that short adjustable one that gives you just like an extra 2 feet off the ground, and they have those built into their costume, or something similar to that. And I always watch them and they're in there, and I'm always amazed by how well they walk on them. They seem to be able to do it just flawlessly.
Yeah, it's really impressive. I mean, they're just walking around, you know, like nobody's business in those things. And
yeah, it's got to take some practice. I think I'd be falling all over the place.
Yeah, I would too. Nobody.
Yeah, I got it. Okay. I heard it and I got it. And I was just like, you know what? I'm not even going to acknowledge it. Let's
come
just
on.
Keep
I need moving. My subtle puns are not rewarding if somebody doesn't at least snicker a little.
All right, there you go. I'm acknowledging it now verbally.
Okay, all right. I mean, I was going to say walking around, but that's not as impressive.
That would have been too obvious, I think. Yeah,
yeah, agreed. But tell us more about Star Wars Weekends. How does the 501st play with Disney? How did they get involved, and what's the relationship, and what are the benefits to participating if you're a member?
Well, the Florida garrison of the 501st has a great working relationship with Disney, and they've been participating in Star Wars Weekends for a number of years now. Both the 501st and the Rebel Legion are invited. And it's a great opportunity because they open that up to all the garrisons worldwide to be able to attend. And every year it seems like they get people that travel in from different garrisons around the world. I know this year there's some that came in from Argentina to be in that parade. And so it's really cool that they open it up to anybody. So this year I put in to troop on one of the days, and I was pretty excited about it. I was hoping to do it last year, and I didn't get the chance to. So I was really excited that I was able to this year because it's a great event and it's a lot of fun.
Yeah, it goes without saying that we're pretty big Star Wars fans here on the show, and we are pretty regular Disney attendees as well. So the recent acquisition was a pretty happy event for us, and then being able to go to a Disney park and see Star Wars on such prominent display, and then to know people participating in that display, all really comes together for a pretty perfect set of circumstances. Brian couldn't attend this year. He had a bodybuilding tournament that he was taking part in. We will, each of us, do that on alternating years.
Third place, baby.
Nice going, man. I mean, only 6 months prep, and you had to go off your Diana ball cycle early, right?
Yeah.
It's all about dehydrating the night before.
Yeah, your tanner
and
was
the oil.
Yeah, the oil. So much oil. For the record, how much bronzer would they need to use to make any of us look like bodybuilders?
I think if you drew a six-pack on me with bronzer with your finger, it would be the best option, I think, to even come close to making me look that way.
I think we need to do like the equivalent of a bodybuilding tournament with people in Stormtrooper armor. What do you think of that, Anthony? You think you could kind of help us get that event together?
Yeah, Stormtrooper armor makes you look pretty buff regardless, so I'd say it's a good start.
Right, I never knew a person who was kind of an endomorph could have pecs, but that armor just brings them out.
Yeah, it's just defines you, no matter who
really.
You are.
Yes.
It's like the E-Honda, you're going to have abs on top of the gut.
Exactly.
Yeah, take it in a whole other geeky direction.
Actually, speaking of bodies, I did want to ask this. What's the female participation like in the 501st? Because the Stormtroopers, I think, at least so far in Star Wars, have been like pretty much exclusively male. Or if there were women in those costumes, they didn't really make a big deal out of it. Are any women playing Stormtroopers?
Oh, yeah, there's a lot of female participation in the 501st. There's women Stormtroopers, TIE pilots, you name it. They're fair game, you know, anything you want to pursue. When somebody's fully suited up in their armor, there's no telling who's in there. So
there are some pretty famous female TIE pilots, if I'm not mistaken.
Oh, that are part of some species of canon or another, Brian? Like they actually are part of the lore?
Yeah.
Oh, that's cool. That's cool. I was kind of wondering about that because, you know, I mean, Star Wars is kind of a product of its times, at least in its original incarnation. And we're talking, you know, the 70s when it first got going. So things weren't quite as inclusive back then. So I wonder how organizations that celebrate Star Wars approach that. And then, of course, I wonder, and I wouldn't mind anybody's prediction on this to include yours, Anthony, whether we're going to see more like females, not just in the ranks of the stars, but in the rank and file, you know, soldier ranks and so on in the new movies.
Yeah, I'll be interested to see where that goes. As far as the Legion, you know, just with the TIE pilots, we're part of what's called the Jolly Roger Squadron, which is the detachment of all of the TIE pilots in the Legion. And there's a separate squadron of all the female TIE pilots called the Black Widows.
That is eminently appropriate for Star Wars, I think, and for TIE pilots in particular.
It is. It's pretty cool.
Are you allowed to be married and be a Black Widow, or if your wife becomes a Black Widow, should you fear for your life?
Yeah, I'd probably be a little concerned.
Yes, yes, indeed.
Let me ask this, because we were talking about what would be approved, and we talked about the lore a little bit, and you said that Brian was mentioning that in the lore there were some female Imperial characters. What's considered canon when it comes to the 500, you know, the 501st? Do you see characters from the books? Would you see characters from Clone Wars? Are we sticking strictly with what Disney has now prescribed as canon?
I'd like to cut you off. There was just a big announcement about this, and let me say I love you guys even more for it.
Yeah, okay.
There was, and are you referring to the what Lucasfilm came out about, the what they said about the expanded universe?
Yeah, what you guys said about the expanded universe.
Yep. And there's a lot of going back and forth about that right now. There's been a lot of discussion, both from what the Legion standpoint has been and Lucasfilm standpoint. I haven't been following it too closely just because I'm not really impacted by it because I don't have any expanded universe characters. And even as a Star Wars fan, I've always kind of poked around in the expanded universe a little bit, but I've never been a really diehard fan on that side of things.
What I was referring to actually was, I think over the weekend, there was a pretty big announcement by, I guess, like whatever 501st Council, that the EU will always be welcome.
Right. Yeah. As far as all of the approved costumes with the 501st, because there are a lot of expanded universe, and yeah, those will always be welcome. Those, you know, the Legion's not turning their backs on those characters. They'll always be a part of the Legion, without a doubt.
I think that's pretty cool, and I mean, I don't see any reason why they wouldn't do it. I understand we've kind of all gone back and forth, and we have mixed feelings on our show here about the treatment of the EU going forward. But I mean, among the fans and people who are fans of the Extended Universe material, Brian would be somebody I would count in that group for sure. Why not keep that stuff going? Like, why would you not still celebrate those characters just because they're kind of not part of the Tier 1 canon anymore?
Yeah, and I'm not sure what the big push was on that. You know, I think trying to clean up some storylines and, you know, something along the lines of that. But yeah, I'm happy to see, because there are some really, really cool expanded universe characters that I've seen in the 501st. I've seen some pretty awesome ones. So I'm glad to see that those will always be around, and at least at that level.
I'm actually kind of curious. So I will admit that I did not do a lot of the post episode 6 reading. Well, I should say I didn't do any. So I don't have the relationship with that material that a lot of people have. I'm kind of surprised that they didn't choose to go with, like, all right, this is the most popular, series to come after episode 6. Let's run with that and tinker with timeline somewhat, but still keep the general thread going. And I think at this point, unless anybody objects, and in honor of the fact that we have another huge Star Wars geek on as our guest this week, I think we should get into a discussion of episode 7 and beyond and where we think they're going to go with that. So do you guys see them pulling in big elements of any particular arc that follows episode 6?
Yeah, I think they will, actually. They're just not saying it because they'd lose interest. People are going to rush right out on day one to see what happens instead of, oh, I know what happens.
And there have been a lot of shots released online recently TMZ got a hold of like 45 on-set shots, which don't show any major characters, but show the sets themselves. And to be honest, I don't know how much of a leak it was or if it was an intentional leak, because they're really like these honestly professional shots of some of the sets. And from what I've seen, a lot of these sets would work when I think about what I've read in Expanded Universe and what I've seen in comics that took place post Episode 6. And then, of course, there was the news recently that showed off the building of the Millennium Falcon again for the new movie.
Did you see the information or the references of some of those photos that were just leaked or released compared to some of the Ralph McQuarrie artwork?
Yeah, they're not really even like using his artwork, it seems like, as kind of a, you know, loose interpretation. They're just recreating his exact artwork for some of those.
Yeah, definitely. Which I think is pretty cool. And I think J.J. Abrams is definitely focusing in on a lot of details like that. I'm just curious to see which directions he's going to go with it and kind of how that's going to drive the whole thing.
You know, before the first, like the prequels came out, there was always this discussion of whether or not Lucas had to appeal to his fan base or whether he had to appeal to general audiences. And that always kind of enraged me. And what I'm seeing so far, I think, is the solution I wanted in the first place for the original episodes was at some point they have to realize that the general audience is the fan base. Like, Star Wars is that big that you're really appealing to everybody at this point. Like, no one is so out of the loop that they're like, I don't get it. What's happening here and why is everyone applauding that character? Most people know.
Yeah, there really aren't any big secrets there. I agree with that. And I'm not envious of J.J. Abrams right now. I think he has some big shoes to fill right there.
And I think there's always going to be criticism. I mean, he got criticism for Star Trek because he took it in kind of a more adventurous, action-based direction for Star Trek. But it's the bottom line is it's still entertaining. He's still attempting to appeal to fans, even if some fans, you know, get a little put off by the fact that it's kind of taking this different turn and they're playing a little bit around with the history more than they would like. But I haven't seen anyone who's genuinely livid. I think ultimately they're just happy to get more Star Trek and Star Trek that doesn't really suck.
Yeah, and let's be honest, he's doing a great job with something that works in a 2-hour movie. I'd really like to see him do a Star Trek series where he had time to get into a more slow-paced story and see where he went with that. But delivering as he does a concise movie package, I think he does an excellent job. And I think in the case of Star Wars, that's going to be great because the Star Wars movies, where they have tried to fit in a pretty wide story arc, have failed to do so. I mean, Anakin's fall, absent any, you know, reading or watching of animated series that come between episode 2 and 3, seems abrupt and kind of for no reason, because at the beginning of the movie he's still kind of a good guy and then he has some bad dreams and worries about his wife and then he's like suddenly killing babies, and that just seemed to happen way too suddenly. And I understand that Lucas was trying to go for this tragic fall of this good man, but he just didn't have time to do it in the course of a movie.
But he should have had time in the course of 3 movies. And one of my biggest problems with episode 1 was that when you really think about it, if you were going to show those movies to someone, do you need to watch episode 1? Is it even necessary? Like, there's no major plot points in episode 1.
Absolutely not. And I think we've gone over this before. I'm sure Hitler was a cute little boy, but it doesn't really have any bearing on the monster he became later. You know what I mean?
Exactly. And by the way, I never brought it up again, but on an episode in the past, I talked about I found that the cut, the episode 3.1, which was a cut of all 3 prequels into 1 decent movie. And I'll admit, 1, it is far more decent, and 2, most of episode 1 is not present. Pretty much, it kicks off with the Darth Maul fight, and then you're in episode 2.
Is that the one that was posted online and then kind of quickly removed?
Yeah, that's the one.
Is that still available somewhere? I never did get to see it.
It is if you call me.
Perfect.
Yeah, there you go.
And we'll extend that to all show listeners. Call Eric, and he will send you a link to this unauthorized but nevertheless awesome reimagining of the episode one Darth Maul battle scene and movies that come after that. But let's step away from story for a minute. I want to get opinions all around on this apparent emphasis on practical effects in the new movies. Now, in the currently running Star Wars series, they're not shy about using CG. So why this, and I'm not complaining, but why this emphasis on using models in the new Star Wars movies? Is it just to please fans, or does it just, and I kind of have my own answer to this, I should let you know, but is it because it you end up with a better looking product at the end, or what?
I actually wouldn't say that it's either. I think that CG has gotten to a point where things look great. I've yet to see a CG movie, let's say in this past year, where I've been like, wow, that was just terrible. CG's pretty much found its place. Nothing looks too rubbery. Things don't stretch in odd positions. The color doesn't look off anymore. You don't get that weird, if I can give an example that I know, Alien 3, like just where you're like, that just doesn't belong there. Like something's off about that. It doesn't look like it's part of that universe or that world. When I go back and watch like the special editions, the things that were added via CG, with the exception of background pieces, don't look like they belong. But the thing is, they're not bad. And so I kept wondering why they don't look like they belong. And I think the use of the more traditional effects is what gave Star Wars its feel. It always had kind of a Muppet-esque feel to it, but it looked good. And I think that's the reality, is that there's a tone and a feel to what made Star Wars Star Wars, and we just want that back.
Yeah, I would agree with that. I think that's definitely, you know, an attempt to keep it kind of close to its roots where it started, kind of give it that same feel that, you know, we all know and love, and probably a little bit of pressure too to try to make the movie closer to the originals than the prequels, just to appease the diehard fans.
Yeah, because when you look at them side by side, a prequel and the original movies, they don't look like the same even genre of film. I mean, you can tell the story is obviously tied together, and the characters, some of the characters are the same, but there's something just really off about the way they look. And it may be the overuse of CG, or it could have been the time they were made that CG has now progressed far beyond where it was then, even though the CG in that movie was still, in the prequels, were still pretty good. But the feel was off. The feel, it didn't look like a Star Wars film. It never did.
Yeah, I think it has to do with CG not aging well, personally. I think that even CG that we think looks good now may not look as good 10 years from now. And what I really want to see is a strong foundation of models and sets, with CG being used to clean things up, to make scenes a little more convincing, to bridge the gaps that I guess practical effects can't quite bridge on their own. And I hate the fact that I'm using practical effects only because I read it somewhere. I'm not like some special effects guy that knows crap about anything. I'm just an audience member, but I hope you get my point. Brian, what do you think? Are you excited, not so jazzed about them going back to the traditional way of making a Star Wars movie?
I'm excited for it, but not so much on the effect that it's going to have visually. I thought the acting in 1, 2, and 3 were really terrible, and I kind of blame that on having to stand on a screen by yourself. Just act to this tennis ball. Like, now that they can interact with people and like actually make eye contact and actually bounce off each other, I hope the acting won't be as terrible.
You know, I've had a theory on the acting. When you watch episode 4, the original Star Wars New Hope, the acting is not great. Mark Hamill is a so-so actor at best. I mean, he's not fantastic. He's a great voice actor, surprisingly enough, but on screen, he's okay. He wasn't terrible, but he wasn't great. But there were some awesome actors. You know, Carrie Fisher did a great job. Harrison Ford is always amazing. And then you had, you know, actors who already had lots of experience, your Alec Guinness and so on. And I think because Lucas was young, he was a little tentative to kind of give them that really push direction. Like, no, here's what I'm looking for. I think he was so, for lack of a better term, full of himself by the time we got to episode 1, that even though there are some decent actors and, or actresses in there. Like, Natalie Portman is a quality actress. Everything, for the most part, that she's been in, she does a very good job. She's not even, like, if there was a range, she's not even in the middle. She's maybe a little above average. You know, I wouldn't call her, like, a world class, but she's a way above average. And the fact that her acting was so atrocious in episode one just tells me that he had either a really piss-poor idea of what he was shooting for, or he was so full of himself and he had this idea of how cold and dry the movie should be that he just literally told actors, like, no, no, no. More monotone, slower, and stop caring so much.
Or to Brian's point, Natalie Portman spent most of her scenes, like, talking to a mop in a bucket with a tennis ball on the end of it. That's Anakin. We'll CG him in later.
Yeah, but I've seen actors do a good job with that stuff. I mean, that's the entirety of the movie Gravity, and from a CG standpoint and from an acting standpoint, the movie's done well.
Yeah, but I don't think Sandra Bullock and George Clooney hated every minute of being in that movie.
But they never even really saw each other in that movie, if you ever watched the making of it. Literally, the only thing that's real in most of that film are their faces.
Okay, your point.
So how stiff could they be?
That's my point. So you would think if all that was going to be on screen was your face, and you're talking to nothing but a room full of lights, because that's what they did film in front of, that you would have no idea what you were looking at or how to act. And those two did a pretty solid job of acting in that movie. So again, I think Natalie Portman can handle it. I've got to believe that they went through these parts so many times that he was like, that's what I'm looking for. Let's move on. And she was probably like, really? Okay.
Anthony, well, where do you come down on this with the acting? Is it a result of the green screen or George Lucas telling you to do stupid stuff or what?
Well, you know, this discussion was making me think, and I can't remember where I read it, but I remember several years ago reading something online about how when they were filming the prequels, how so many cast and crew members were constantly questioning things and thinking to themselves how terrible some of those ideas seemed, but nobody spoke up because nobody wanted to speak up and question what George Lucas was thinking.
So right, that was my point.
Like, yeah, so they just didn't say, they just went with it and didn't say anything. And it was kind of like after the fact, you know, they were like, well, hey, maybe we should have spoke up, but nobody ever did. Yeah, and I think that was probably a huge part of it. It was kind of like, you know, hey, I'm not going to question what George Lucas is thinking. You know, it's his, he's the genius behind it.
And I wonder how often that happens, because if we go way back, and you guys know where I'm going to go with this already, but if we look at Prometheus and we look at Ridley Scott, he did an awesome job with Alien, and all those actors did a fantastic job. I mean, the acting in the original Alien, at least the original, is amazing. And then you look at Prometheus, I got to believe that all of those young actors in Prometheus were just like, he's Ridley Scott. Like, of course, we just have to listen to whatever he says.
Yeah, well, I think that's probably a huge, huge component.
Well, then I think that probably augurs well for the future of the Prometheus franchise, because episodes 2 and 3 got better than episode 1 was, as people started to recognize that George Lucas, though he had accomplished a lot, wasn't perfect. And I got to imagine that the scene where Slave One, the awesome Slave One scene in the asteroid belt in episode 2 probably involved a giant space Gungan. And then somebody stepped in and said, George, let's just cool it with the Gungans for the rest of the series.
You know, there's something about episode 2 that will always make me just loathe it. And it's literally 2 seconds worth of footage. 2 seconds. And when Jar Jar showed up, and I already knew, I mean, I read everything that they were like, okay, we're not going to overuse Jar Jar. He is in one small scene. And I said, okay, I can just kind of hold my breath and get through it, and I'll be all right. It's just one small bit of Jar Jar. I'll live. And that scene came up, and I was a little annoyed, but I'm like, I know it's going to be over in a minute. And at the end of that scene, Jar Jar stops, looks at the camera, and grins as if George Lucas was just going like, yeah, bitches, I'm still here.
He's taunting the audience?
Yeah, literally, it looks like he's taunting the audience.
He probably was like, all right, I concede to not having any more Jar Jar, but we are definitely going to have a cameo by Boba Fett then.
I have to look this up. I saw before the movie came out, I think it was 60 Minutes. I saw one of those primetime specials where they were like exclusive footage from the new movie, and it showed it was Lucas, like, picking pieces off of these models. Like, oh, I really like this one's ears, and oh, this one's feet, yeah. And oh my god, this one, I love this one. And putting them together. And I'm pretty sure that's how he came up with Jar Jar. Like, yanking sensible pieces off of other aliens.
Oh, god.
You know what's funny about that is the irony of it, and everyone talks about Lucas, in a way, playing God with Star Wars, and it's his creation, so I suppose he has some right. But Jar Jar really is kind of the duck-billed platypus of Star Wars. Like, he's just made of random parts, and he even has the duck bill to go with it. So
yes, well, that really bolsters Brian's supposition that George Lucas just, like, went into the effects studio, ooh, fine, and started, like, just assembling a friggin' chimera, and that chimera became Jar Jar.
You know, if Lucas did intentionally have Jar Jar look at the screen and kind of give that impression, if he intentionally did that, I have to say that probably is going to make me like that scene even more, because that's kind of awesome on George Lucas's part to do that.
I'm absolutely convinced it was on purpose.
I want
to
go watch that.
And he's the director. He obviously, like, had to say, here's what I want Jar Jar to do on this particular, you know, like, he has to give that level of direction to people. Like, can we have him do this or look this way? I mean, that's exactly what directors do. So it had to be on purpose. It absolutely had to be.
That was his way of giving his fans the finger.
That's exactly what it was. That is 100% what it was.
Okay, so he gave us the finger, but then things were never as bad as episode one again for the rest of the series. I'm not saying they were great, but never as bad as episode one.
I don't think, as much as they were his script, I don't think two and three were truly the vision he wanted. And he was like, crap, I really have to appeal to people because I really messed up with episode one. So I'm going to do them kind of my way and kind of their way, but I'm still going to give them a big F you right there in the middle of it.
Okay, so he did it. Let's say he did it. And again, I'll mention, that means that Prometheus is going to be that much better, because I will put Prometheus, though it had its flaws, well ahead of episode one. So I think we can hope for better things from Prometheus. But the real question I want to get to is, with episode seven, where do we stand? Because we have Abrams coming in, and he is not a Star Wars guy, but he is a god among human beings, right? People look up to him. Is he potentially going to just walk in and make a complete mess of this, and have all of his sycophants and underlings too afraid to say anything? I mean, could we see a bad episode seven followed up by a better eight and nine this time around?
I don't think he's that big yet.
He's had enough stature, especially like in a geek community sense, because of Lost and because of now Star Trek and because of Alias, that I think he's big enough that people have expectations.
And I think he's going into this as a fan of Star Wars, you know, so I think he feels that pressure. He's probably putting a lot of pressure on himself, knowing that he has to do it right. At least in my mind, I'm hoping that's what he's doing.
Me too, actually. And
yeah, he doesn't get a pass for being George Lucas.
Okay, for being the original creator. Okay.
Right.
Is he responsible for only the mainline Star Wars ones, or is he doing all the in-between spin-off movies too?
No, didn't they just announce that the director from Godzilla was going to be doing one of the spin-offs?
Yeah, they said he's doing the first spin-off, although they didn't announce what the first spin-off is, but it's right. Literally right after the episode 7, like the very next summer.
Yep.
I like that. I know we are of mixed minds here on the Godzilla movie, I think, but that makes me kind of happy to know.
Yeah, I think that's really promising.
Yeah, I'm happy about it. My only concern is I don't know what they're going to do or how they're tying it together. If they're going to continue to do these spinoffs, and from right now, what I understand, the plan is a traditional episodic Star Wars film one summer, the next summer spinoff, the next episode the following summer, and then again the following summer spinoff, and basically this back and forth. In one interview, and I'll have to find it if I can, someone even suggested from the studio that the idea was to do a Star Wars film every summer for the next 7 years, starting in 2015. So I have no idea what to expect from those.
I read something similar, and that makes me happy. I just hope they're good. I could deal with, like, 7 great years of Star Wars stuff.
I assume that some of the spinoffs are going to be prequels. I think they've kind of hinted at that. I just don't know if they're going to do spinoffs that also kind of tie episodes together through an individual character's story. Like, for example, if there's an episode, if there's a, you know, you get episode 8 and then episode 9 is Two Summers Away, will the spinoff in between be a separate character storyline that kind of arcs those two movies?
It's a good question, one we can't answer. But I can ask you guys some more questions that you hopefully can. I've got two more lines of thought before we let Anthony return to his laboratory to work on his next costume. First of all, one more episode 7 question, and then we'll get back to the 501st to wrap things up. Are we going to see a slowing down and a return to the more traditional, slow-paced but no less dramatic lightsaber battle, or are we going to see more highly choreographed, dancing around, wire foo type stuff like we saw in the prequel trilogy?
I'll go out on a limb. I don't think we're going to have a lot of lightsabers.
Yeah, I think we're going to be back down to one or two lightsabers total in the film, because at the end of episode 6, you're literally down to one lightsaber. So unless the Sith are returning, which I'm assuming there's got to be some evil entity to deal with, and assuming Luke's going to train somebody and take on a Padawan, you're going to deal with maybe three lightsabers?
And is Luke going to teach his Padawan the error of his ways? When his Padawan starts doing silly flips, is Luke just going to like kick him off a platform?
Maybe, of course, you know, unless they go the route of some of the expanded universe stuff and Luke himself is the Sith.
Interesting. What do you think, Anthony? And by the way, if you're a fan of the much more fast-paced lightsaber fighting in the original trilogy, don't let me force you to come around to my point of view. What do you think?
Yeah, I agree with what everybody else is saying. I don't think we're going to see a whole lot of lightsabers. I definitely hope we have some. I wouldn't mind kind of a balance between the two, really.
Yeah, I'd like just enough for it to be novel. You know, a few potato chips, not the whole freaking bag. Because by the end of episode 3, I was literally like sitting in the theater saying to whomever it was I was with, you know, enough with the lightsabers. Like, it was just getting excessive. It was kind of like the action scenes in the second Hobbit movie. Enough, please. Can we just get a break? That's how I felt at the end.
To make this easier, what's everybody's favorite on-screen lightsaber battle?
Oh, come on. That's basic. But you guys go first.
Luke, Vader, Bespin.
Yes.
Yeah, I would agree with that.
I have in my mind this cut of Qui-Gon, Obi-Wan, Darth Maul that doesn't suck. So, deluded though I maybe be, that's my favorite.
I can accept that. That was really good. It was flippy and high-paced, but not as ridiculous as what we saw in the later movies. I would even put that as a number 2 battle. That would have to duke it out with Luke's final charge of Vader at the end of Jedi.
Just love how animalistic Maul is, like pacing back and forth, like slashing at the barriers between them.
Yeah.
Just to show off.
Yeah, that was really cool.
And it's hard not to like Ray Park's choreography.
That was excellent.
Yeah, it's in any of the movies he does, it's really hard. Be it Hellboy or anything else.
Yeah, I have to say, like, his choreography added everything to that battle, and I think the thing that both of them share is sort of the juxtaposition between like the dark side and the, what did Luke call it, the good side in Jedi, whatever. You had the sort of meditating Jedi Knights, Qui-Gon, and you had the pacing, like, you know, almost foaming at the mouth Darth Maul in that battle, and then when you had Vader and Luke, you had like the cool collected evil of Vader and the just brash, like, hopelessly outmatched Luke. Were you going to say something, Brian?
Maul was prowling. He was just prowling back and forth like a caged animal. That's the word you're looking for.
Yeah, that was cool. I remember that being really, really cool. And I think the tension in the fight is as impressive as the flipping and you know, Yoda actually being a frog after all and jumping all around.
I mean, I know it's obvious to say, and I'm not saying anything that anyone doesn't agree with or doesn't know, but Maul is the one thing to take away from episode one that's even, you know, remotely quality. And whoever made the cut that I watched, the episode 3.1, definitely knew that and was like, okay, we'll just throw this right at the beginning. They even used the crawl to kind of intro what's happening on screen as you go to the Maul fight. Like, that's just where the action of the movie kicks off. And then it just moves on.
That's awesome, man. Totally cool. Yeah, we could talk about how they kind of wasted Darth Maul and how he was the best part of episode one by a long shot. But goes without saying, and I did want to bring focus back over to the 501st and its future with regards to the new movies as we sort of wrap things up. So, Anthony, make a prediction. What kind of – and, you know, this is based on knowing nothing about the new movies, so just shoot here from the hip. What additions to the 501st Legion and the Rebel Legion do you think we could see post episode 7 and beyond? Just what kind of crazy new stuff do you think we're going to see out there?
Yeah, I'm sure there's going to be a lot of new characters introduced, probably some new armor types and, you know, some new storylines. So that'll definitely add some exciting new elements to the 501st and the Rebel Legion. So I'm sure we'll see some new costumings, ideas popping up after the movies come out. I think there's just going to be so much hype, you know, leading up to the release of these movies. It's going to be a pretty exciting time. I know it's going to be an exciting time for the 501st because I know we'll be out. We'll be doing events at a lot of the movie theaters on opening nights, and that's all going to be really fun. I'm really looking forward to that. And then potentially a new movie every year for the next 7 years. That's a lot of events to look forward to. So I hope it's all successful because that sounds really fun.
Go ahead. Is there a lot of excitement in the group with the idea or notion that there are going to be new costumes to do?
I haven't heard a whole lot of discussion about that. I think as time goes on, there will be. I think you said it earlier, Eric, wondering if those leaked pictures were intentional. I was wondering the same thing. I kind of think they were intentional just to build the hype, and I think we're going to probably see a lot more of that. And I think as we start seeing, you know, sneak peeks of little things, I think there'll be a lot more discussion about the future of costuming and what's going to be out there.
I think you'll see some kind of forward-looking or forward-leaning cutting-edge costuming. I mean, I know Eric's own brother went to, what was it, the Star Wars premiere or the tickets or something for episode one in a pre-release Darth Maul costume. Is that right, Eric?
It was a convention that was held in South Florida, mostly like a toy show, that was held the weekend just prior to the movie release. So he dressed up for that. There was a picture of him right on the front of the Sun Sentinel, of course, because everyone was building the hype, even our local newspapers. And then we actually got to see the movie 2 weeks early, which is still just kind of a point for Jordan to grit his teeth, because I got a pass to see it as one of those like pre-screenings, and he didn't. So instead, he stood in line with me and just waited until someone was willing to sell their pre-screening ticket for $50. And that's his point of fury. It's not that he had to spend $50 or that he waited in line or he didn't get a ticket. It's that he spent $50 for a ticket.
To episode one.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
But to the point, do you guys, especially you, Anthony, do you see maybe as leaked stuff comes out, some people just kind of going for it with the costumes and maybe trying to put a costume together based on some leaked photos that come out or things like that?
I'm sure there will definitely be some of that. As far as 501st, I doubt anything will be approvable before the movies come out because, I'm sure all that will come after the fact once it's all actual, officially released. I'm sure then there'll be approved costumes, but I'm sure there'll be non-Legion members and, you know, just fans out there, a lot of fan-built costumes. I'm sure we'll definitely be seeing a lot of that.
Okay, so the 501st doesn't have, like, a rife speculation brigade of people just kind of dressing up as what they think might be coming out.
No, not that I'm aware of.
Okay, that makes a lot of sense. Well, do you guys have any other questions for Anthony? Anthony, do you have any other points or questions for us?
Well, I want to ask how we get involved. Where does someone go if they want to join?
Well, best resource is the website, 501st.com. There's boatloads of information on there. You can check out the costume reference libraries where you can see all the details of every costume that you could build, all the information. There's links to the detachment for each costume group where you can get lots of information and talk to other people and a lot of resources for building those and everything you need to put into it. And you can also find get links to your local garrisons, find out who's local in your area and find contacts there. So it's really a good one-stop shop for all of that. Or just go out to an event that the 501st is going to be at and talk to some members. You know, they're usually more than willing to talk about the Legion, so you could definitely get some good information that way.
Kick-ass, anything else? We will be sure to share that information, by the way. You guys have any other questions for Anthony? Anything else?
Just one. Nerdstravaganza is planning on having a presence at an Asheville event that's coming up in August, the Asheville Toy Expo, which is August 8th, I believe. Should we expect a 501st presence?
That event was posted on the 501st Legion forums, and we will definitely have a few troopers there. I'm hoping we'll have as many as we can possibly get, but I know for a fact we will definitely have at least two or three present for that. So there'll definitely be somebody there to talk to.
Outstanding. Look for Eric and I to be in attendance at our booth dressed as gigantic Ewoks.
Excellent.
All right. I think that is pretty much a wrap. Anthony, I can't thank you enough for being on. It was awesome to see you in the parade during Star Wars weekends. We hope to see you at a future such event and at our Ewok heavy booth at the aforementioned expo. And I think that's all I can say, man. Thanks a lot for being on. I will let Brian and Eric say their niceties and you can return them. And then we will let you get back to crafting your latest and greatest creation.
All right, Anthony, thanks for being on. Send me a message and I will send you a link.
Thanks for joining us, Anthony. It's been an honor, and keep up the good work, man. Seriously, I'm proud of you guys.
And thank you guys for having me. I had a blast. It was really fun talking about 501st and the future of Star Wars. I look forward to seeing some of you guys up in Asheville at the Asheville Toy Expo. We'll see you guys there.
Awesome, man. Until then, may the Schwartz be with you. Okay, guys, so I thought that was a pretty cool interview. There's nothing really more fun than doing a little Star Wars geeking out, and I don't think you can get any higher on the Star Wars geek ladder than a member of the 501st. Do you guys agree?
Member of the cast?
Yeah, I'm sorry. I don't think, short of somebody involved in the actual making of the movies, it's hard to imagine getting higher, right?
You don't think we could get higher?
Yeah, there you go. That's probably the way I should have said it.
Yeah, Brian definitely beat me to the punch on that one. It was right there.
Yeah, so I thought that was great. I thought that went very well, and I was kind of, I'd heard of the 501st. It's always been around. I've heard of that name used in games and here and there in the canon, but it was really cool to get some insight into the organization, what they do, what they stand for, and actually I thought the charity stuff that they did was pretty badass.
Yeah, I like the nerd helping angle. I've seen some other organizations doing it on smaller scales, but it's really cool that their like mission statement includes that.
Yeah, I agree, and I've actually got to see some of it in person. Last time I was in Asheville, the 501st participated in Barnes & Noble's Star Wars Reads Day, and they actually came out in costume, greeted kids, read to kids in costume. It was pretty awesome.
Yeah, it sounds like they're pretty active in the community at large. And, geez, I think it takes a lot. It's a really awesome thing, especially that they participate in Make-A-Wish, man. I've given money to that organization. My mom has worked in, like, the back office for that organization and stuff. But to be the person that actually has to get there and comfort these kids in, you know, an unimaginably dire time. That takes a special kind of person, man.
I really liked how Anthony kind of, those are hard. Those are hard, but you do it. I like that, you know, people acknowledge it's not always like, oh, I get to go out and have fun. I am a stormtrooper. Yay. No, he's, you know, putting himself out there for some kid he doesn't even know.
Yeah, that's a pretty awesome thing to do for someone. And on just the purely geeky side of things, I think it's pretty awesome that they have like a command structure and like the Legion subdivided into, what were the smaller units called?
It depends on the smaller unit. For example, the TIE fighter pilots, the men were the Jolly Roger. And then the women were the Black Widows. And I'm sure they have it for other costumes, but those are the only ones I picked up.
Or were they the garrisons?
That's what I was trying to get to.
Oh, okay.
Garrisons, squadrons.
Yeah, et cetera. I like the organization. That's pretty cool. And I also like that, like, if you want to join, you can just approach them and start that process. But what was the requirement? You can't go out and, like, buy just, like, a 501st endorsed costume. You actually have to make or have made a costume of sufficient quality, of movie – what is it?
Of movie quality, yeah.
Yeah, it has to be on-screen accurate. And actually, one of the funny things about the parade was that the 501st marched early on in the parade, and there they just look fantastic. I mean, it's literally like watching characters straight out of the movie walk across. And then Disney had their own set of costumes that kind of did like the performances around the park. They were towards the end of the parade. They were up on these, you know, pedestals and podiums, standing guard. They were on the stage, and their costumes kind of sucked compared to the 501st. Like, you could tell they just looked like they were made of like inferior materials. The detailing just wasn't there. I mean, they looked okay. I wouldn't mind having one of those, you know, the Disney costumes, but they didn't hold up compared to the 501st.
Yeah, you know, and I wonder if that comes down to a difference between devoted fans, you know, spending their time and money and effort to make excellent costumes versus, you know, somebody who has a budget putting together costumes for shows and parades at a theme park. I mean, that must account for it.
Disney has a budget?
Well, you've got to assume so. They are running those parks to make a profit.
I guess so, but, you know, it's hard to fathom.
Yeah, I know, with all the money that comes in. I really wonder if we're going to see, like I said, I mentioned it a few times. We all mentioned it a few times. The 501st has been, there's been some flirtation with Star Wars proper, as it were, as an intellectual property sort of conglomerate, and the 501st Legion. I wonder if we're going to see an official kind of role for them, you know, in some capacity in the future, especially as it looks like we're going to have like a decade of Star Wars coming up.
It could be, because basically the backstory is that, I mean, in the lore, is that the 501st were the troops that served directly under Vader's command. That was his squadron.
Ah.
So it's possible that they remain loyal even after his passing, and maybe that's a part they play in the next ones.
That would be pretty cool. That would be awesome if it was written into the new movies. That would give the costuming group an even higher level of, I almost said gravitas, and I guess I'm just going to say gravitas for lack of a better word. I think it would make being part of the 501st even cooler for the members. And let's see, beyond talking about the 501st, we got into some pretty in-depth discussion of Star Wars and Episode 7 and beyond. I know we've kind of been talking about that for some time. I really liked that Anthony was kind of on board with what we were thinking. It proves that our minds are leaning in the right direction, I think. Especially with regard to like lightsaber fights and the new special effects regime being put in place, the new old special effects regime being put in place for the new movies and so on.
I really hope we're right about the sabers. I'd like to return to that rare special feeling when they come out, as opposed to just every other scene. Oh, look, he's got three blades. Oh, wow.
Yeah, I mean, I know I was kind of on a tear when it came to that, but do you guys agree? Like, by the end of episode 3, I was just like, man, I had like lightsaber fatigue. Like, please, not another one.
I don't think I ever have lightsaber fatigue, but I definitely could have done with a maybe more slow, methodical battle than the kind of hyper-esque ones they really gave to us.
Yeah. By the end of well, you had the Obi-Wan Anakin fight going on, or I guess he was Darth Vader by that time, and the Palpatine Yoda frog battle going on. And I already wasn't too happy about Yoda being a frog. and using a lightsaber in the first place. So that, I was just, I mean, it looked cool. I will admit it was like cool to see in the theater, but I just really didn't want to see that. And I was done with it. And the Obi-Wan Darth Vader one just seemed way too drawn out.
No, that was, it was almost like it was shot in 3D to me. Oh, look at these guys hovering over lava. See the lava flying right at you. Oh.
It was that filmed with 3D in mind.
Yeah, it had nothing to do with the story. I mean,
yeah, that was about getting as many cool like shots in as you could, I think.
Yeah, if I were to say I had a second favorite lightsaber battle in the prequels after Darth Maul, it's the Anakin Dooku one from early on in episode 2.
Yeah, yeah, where he quickly kind of incapacitates Obi-Wan.
I like Count Dooku as a character. I like his style. I thought he was a good addition. And I liked that that battle was kind of... It had more of a flow to it because they didn't have to CG too much. And it kind of was just to the point.
Yeah, I liked it too. What got ruined for me was when Yoda walked in and instead of casting spells, like, oh, jump around I will. And like all the, ooh, he's going to do it, ooh, in the theater and everything. Like, the hairs on my arm stood up during that, but not necessarily in a good way. I was just like, it was my hackles getting up, I think. So yeah, the Dooku fight was decent. I didn't really mind Dooku. I thought he was a good character. He was no Darth Maul, but I thought he and, I'm with you, the scenes when he fights with his lightsaber were pretty well done.
Yeah, and I meant to say episode 3. That's the beginning of episode 3, but that's really what my brain does to those films. Plus, I just watched that 3.1 cut, and it kind of mushes everything together, so I don't remember what's what.
You mean the fight where he actually loses?
Right.
Yeah, he fights pretty well in that one. Like, he's like force chokes one of them while he's like battling the other one. Like, Dooku's a competent fighter, and I would have somehow liked to see him and Maul in action at the same time, you know? But that's neither here nor there now. What's in the past is in the past. We can only look forward to the future with great optimism. So, Brian, Eric, you guys think you're going to be joining up with the 501st anytime soon?
I have considered it. My issue with it is mostly financial.
Yeah.
My issue with it is mostly talent. I really don't think I could go about crafting movie perfect armor.
Yeah, same here. Unless I need a guy to play. Well, I couldn't even do that. I was going to say like the four-armed diner guy from episode 2, Dax or whatever his name is, but here I am thinking that's just like an easy like slob short order cook to do, but even that costume would be super challenging. I just don't have the talent to do that.
One piece of stubble out of place and you're not in.
This is not movie quality. Yeah, I don't have the talent to do it, and I think commissioning somebody to do it for me would be cheating. So I think I will just remain a fan. But maybe, I don't know, if they need like a 501st like schlub auxiliary, I'm in. But until such time as any of us are drafted into such schlub auxiliary, I think we should content ourselves with doing our podcast. And I think that our listeners will be more than content to learn, if they don't already know, that they can listen to our podcast on a weekly basis by subscribing via iTunes or whatever podcatching software they happen to use, or by checking us out on the excellent streaming service known as Stitcher.
Or they're free, of course, to join our own garrison by liking us on Facebook, following us on Twitter and Instagram, plus wanting us on Google+, and joining the Inner Circle private group on Facebook.
Check out our own personal holocron at nerdstravaganza.com or drop us a line on our comm link at nerdstravaganza@gmail.com.
And with that excellent working in of holocron out of the way, I am displeased as ever to say that another edition of the Nerdstravaganza podcast is at an end. That's a wrap.
Yep.
Yeah.